Am I on? Welcome to the second lecture in my series on universal algebra for CSP. Let me begin by addressing a question that arose at the end of the first lecture. Remember, at the end of the first lecture, I stated and proved a result that I called a dichotomy, an algebraic dichotomy, and it was the one that said whenever you have an algebra, then either there exists a reflexive, not symmetric digraph compatible with some member of the variety generated by that algebra, or in the alternative, the algebra has a three-area operation in its clone satisfying Maltsev's identities. So that was the statement, and the question had to do with condition one and whether you need to look in the for this non-symmetric digraph, whether you need to look throughout the whole variety or whether it could just be found perhaps in the algebra itself. The proof that I gave produced, in case condition two failed, it produced indirectly, it produced such a reflexive non-symmetric digraph compatible with the free algebra on two generators in the variety, and that happens to be buildable as a subalgebra of a power of A, but a fairly large power depending on the cardinality of A. Anyway, so the question was, do we really need to look there, or deep into high subpowers or quotients of subpowers in the generated variety, or might it already be findable lower down? And I mentioned in the idempotent case, there are results known that you don't need to look very far. But in general, the answer is no, you have to, in general, look far. And here is one way to show that with a standard classical example. So here's the example. Fix your finite set. Schupetsky clone on that set consists of all operations which either depend on only one variable or a constant or are not surjective. This set of operations turns out to be a clone. You can check that it contains all the projections, since projections depend on just one variable. And you can show that it's closed under composition by considering all the possible ways that you could take one of these things and apply it to a bunch of these things. And if it's going to be surjective, it must be because all of the pieces had to be, or the relevant pieces had to depend on only one variable. And so the composition doesn't work. Anyway, it's a clone. And note that if we let A be the algebra, which has this as its clone, then this algebra clearly is not in case two of the theorem. The theorem requires, case two requires that there be some three-area operation in the clone, which, these two identities are going to mean it can't depend on only one of its variables. It clearly will depend on all three of its variables if it satisfies those two identities. Sorry? Projections are always surjective, yes. So are you worried about how could this? Okay, well, I'm taking the union. So throw into the clone either operations that depend on one variable. Yeah. This is already the whole clone. Yes, and that's the point. It is already the whole clone, and I claim that it cannot contain a Maltsev operation, an operation satisfying the conditions here, because the identities would force it to depend on all three variables and also be surjective. I mean, for every x, I can force f to have value x by seeking inappropriate values. So this clone does not satisfy item 2, and therefore, by the theorem, there must exist in the variety generated by this algebra another algebra which has compatible to it a reflexive but not symmetric digraph. And I'll leave to you as an exercise, and if you actually aren't just kind of painfully waiting for the stuff in universal algebra to finish and be done with, but we're kind of thinking you'd like to get your hands dirty a little bit, well, here's an exercise worth trying. Show that if n isn't too big, less than half the size of the cardinality of the domain of the algebra on which we built the clone, then no algebra which is a homomorphic image of a subpower, well, of a subalgebra of the nth power of A can witness item one. It can't have a compatible reflexive not symmetric digraph. The only way to witness this, in other words, is to force is to choose a higher power of A and a subalgebra of it, and possibly a homomorphic image of that. Okay, so anyway, thank you for that question. Thank you for the question. Do you have any other questions arising from my first lecture that you'd like to ask now before I go on? All right, let's go on. Today I want to talk a little bit about the constraint satisfaction problem, and Andre has been talking a lot about the constraint satisfaction problem, but he assures me that what I have to say he hasn't covered. I've actually been skipping on these lectures, so I can't say for certain that what I'm going to present now you don't already know, but anyway, it needs to be covered from my perspective, so today I'm going to cover it. Recall that the fixed template constraint satisfaction problem in general goes like this. You fix a finite relational structure, and then the constraint satisfaction problem for that structure, for this template, has, you know, at least two different ways of presenting it, the constraints version and the homomorphism version. In the constraints version, the inputs of the problem are variables, a set of variables, and some constraints on those variables, which amount to requiring that given tuples of variables must belong to specific relations that are always chosen from amongst the basic relations of the structure. And the question is, does there exist an assignment of values from the domain of the structure to the variables which satisfies all the constraints? Okay, so you've heard that. And then there's the homomorphism version, which is exactly equivalent to the constraints version, in which the input is another relational structure of the same signature as the template, and the question asked is whether there exists a homomorphism from that structure to the fixed template. So that's the problem that we're talking about. It's parameterized by whatever fixed template G we started with. And now let's look at some examples. Okay, so right. I guess let's do it from the slides. G1, okay? All of the next sequence of examples will have domain 0, 1. But the relations will vary, okay? So in this case, by R sub ABC, I just mean all triples except the triple ABC. And the structure, the template I'm looking at in this example is the one that has all such relations, all such three-area relations. If you think about it, I look at an example. What is R101? What is it? Well, it's everything except 101. And so that means to say that a triple belongs to it is to say that this triple is not 101. With 1 being true and 0 being false, that means it's saying that either X is false or Y is true or Z is false. So an assertion of membership in R101 is just this, it's equivalent to this kind of assertion in Boolean logic. And since we're throwing in all possible, you know, ABCs, you know, all possible relations of this kind, we can say all possible expressions of this kind. In other words, we can say instances of three set. The constraint satisfaction problem, that is, for this structure is just three set. And we know that's hard, NP complete. Second example. Well, same domain, the relational structure just has 0, 1 for its domain, but now just two relations, again, both ternary relations, S0 and S1. S0 is the set of triples X, Y, Z, whose Boolean sum is 0, and S1 is the ones whose Boolean sum is 1. What can instances of the constraint satisfaction problem for G2 say? Well, all that they can say is they can look at three variables and say they sum up to zero or they sum up to one. And I suppose you could apply S0 to X, X, and Z, okay? And then it would say that Z equals zero. It would say X plus Z equals zero. That means Z equals zero. But basically, that's all that it can do. In other words, instances of this constraint satisfaction problem are just systems of linear equations over the two-element field, in which each equation has just three variables. Okay. Yes?
Can you remind us how you do this program as a homomorphic linear problem?
Sure, yeah. I'll do it right here. Let's take CSP G2. From the homomorphism perspective, what matters is the signature of the template. In this case, the signature is two three-area relations. Okay. Now, forget about what they actually are. Just think two three-area relations. The input is any finite structure H. It can have anything, any finite set for its domain, and it can have any free area relations at all. But two of them, okay? This is a relational structure of the same signature as G2, and the question is, does there exist a homomorphism from the input structure to G2? Now, I'm not sure if that answered your question, that is exactly what the version is. Is that what you meant, or were you asking how do you translate the usual constraints version instance to this kind of instance? Well, let me continue talking, okay? to translate this kind of instance, a system of linear equations in which each equation has three variables, into this kind of instance, what do you do? Well, given a system of linear equations, let's say, just as an example, x1 plus x3 plus x7 equals 0, x2 plus x3 plus x4 equals 1, x3 plus x3 plus x4 equals 0. I'll stop there. As a typical system of equations of the kind where you have zeros or ones, from this instance, we build a structure now, H, that will be the corresponding instance of the homomorphism version. And how do we do it? Well, in this case, we have seven variables. Okay, so the domain of this instance will just be, let's say, the numbers 1 through 7. I could have put the variables x1 through x7. And now I have to say what t0 and t1 will be. Well, in t0, I'm just going to put the triples whose corresponding variables were required to sum to zero in the linear equation. So that would be x1, x3, that would be 1, 3, 7, because x1 plus x2 plus x7 was required to be zero, and 3, 3, 4. 3, 3, 4. That's what I put into t0. And likewise for t1, well, I only have one constraint of this kind, so I put 2, 3, 4. Now, this is a really stupid-looking relational structure, but the point is that there will be a homomorphism from this structure to G2 precisely if this system of equations has a solution. Did that answer your question? Good, okay. Okay, so now this was an example of a constraint satisfaction problem where this now is the template, and it's similar to in appearance to three set, but it isn't similar to three set because we can test systems of linear equations for whether they have a solution by using Gaussian elimination, and done appropriately, it's something that runs in polynomial time over a fixed finite field. So So this constraint satisfaction problem, the one with template G2, is in P. Okay. G4. What is it? Well, again, Boolean domain, three relations. The first of them, I call LA, it's just the less than or equal to relation. Okay. X less than or equal to Y. 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1. We saw that as a directed graph, two loops and one edge. And then C0 is the singleton unary relation 0, and C1 is the singleton unary relation containing 1. So those are the three relations you're allowed to put in. Now, what can a constraint, what can an instance of this constraint satisfaction problem say about the variables? What constraints can be placed on the variables with using just these constraints? That's the question that has to be asked. And, well, you can say one variable is less than or equal to another variable. That's, you've got LE to say that. You can say one variable equals 0 using C0. You can say one variable equals 1. And that's all that you can say. That's all that an instance of CSP of this structure can say. Okay. How can a system of constraints of that kind fail to have a solution? There's only one way. The only way you can get a contradiction is if one of the constraints forces a variable to equal 1, another constraint forces another variable, or maybe the same variable, to equal 0, and then there be sort of a chain of constraints from x1 to xn forcing the preceding one to always be less than or equal to the succeeding one. If there were constraints that are requiring this sort of thing, then automatically there is no solution, but if there aren't, then there is automatically a solution. So this, and this is easy to check. This problem, can you get from one thing to another thing by a directed path, is known as reachability. It's known to be solvable in polynomial time. And in fact, in non-deterministic log space. Okay, and I wondered where G3 went. Here it is. G3, again, Boolean domain, three relations, like G4, but instead of the less than or equal to relation, we just take the equality relation. Okay. Same story. Instances of this CSP can't say very much. They can just say either two things are equal, or one thing equals 0, one thing equals 1. There's only one way, essentially, that a system of such constraints can be inconsistent, not have a solution. What it's encoding is undirected reachability this time, rather than directed reachability, and that's even easier than reachability. Certainly, it's in polynomial time. Even better, it's in log space. Okay, G5. This is not an unending. I'm not going to fill all 90 minutes with G27. You know, but anyway, G5. What is it? Boolean domain. I've got singleton set 0, singleton set 1 again, and then R110. That's all triples except the triple 110. Think of this relation as saying the following. For x, y, z to belong to it is to say that it's not the triple where x and y are true and z is false. Okay. So it's just expressing that x and y, the truth of x and y implies the truth of z. So think of this relation as saying x and y implies z. Okay. Now this is similar to G4. That was the ordering one, the one with the less than or equal to. X less than or equal to y is like saying x implies y. Okay, now we have x and y implies z. If you analyze how a system of constraints using these relations could fail to be true, it's a little more complicated than just having a path. You can have maybe this is set equal to 1, and this is set equal to 1, and then an R110 instance constraint applied to these two variables, and this forces this variable to be 1, and then you can maybe have something else that's required to be 1, and then these two variables and a third variable force this one to equal 1 and so forth. And you could eventually get to some point where something was forced to be 0, and that can't be as a contradiction. So instead of having sort of detecting a path that goes from things forced to be 1 to something forced to be 0, you have a directed binary tree of things whose leaves are required to be one and whose root is required to be zero. But that's essentially the only thing that can be said, and one can test that. It's known as Horn 3 set, known to be solvable in polynomial time. And this is my last example. We're finally going to move on. Kn is the complete undirected graph on n vertices. Literally, the edge relation then is the disequality relation. A pair AB is in it if and only if A does not equal B. So here's a picture of K2, here's a picture of K3, and just thinking of the homomorphism version of the problem, we know that the constraint satisfaction problem for Kn is equivalent to n colorability, which is NP complete usually, except in the case when n is 2, and in that case, it's exceedingly easy in log space. I'm going to leave examples. So are there any questions that you want to ask about these examples? Many of you will already know these examples very well and are bored out of your mind. Yes. Well, with respect to some reduction that is weaker than a polynomial time reduction, like log space reduction. Yeah. So P complete just, it means it's in P, but presumably there's nothing more you can say about it. It's presumably not in non-deterministic log space even. If these words mean something to you, then great. But P complete means P, but it's pretty hard P. Okay. Sorry? That's also true. We assume. Okay. Now here's a summary. Just, you know, it's after lunch. Got to give you something. Pictures, okay? So I draw hardness down at the bottom. So the NP complete is at the bottom, and P is up, okay? And non-interpretive log space is even easier, and log space even easier than that. Here's the complete graphs, K3, K4, and so on. And way on the other end, K2. Okay, G1, what was G1? Oh, that was 3-sat. That was this, that thing right there, 3-sat. G2 was the Boolean sum thing. And G4 had less than or equal. G5 had the thing I've encoded Hornsat, this three-ary thing that I was talking about in this picture. G3, I think, was just equality. I think G3 was just equality. Okay. So anyway, so that's a picture kind of saying, okay, we've got these things scattered. And note in particular that all of the examples are either NP complete or NP. Essentially, what I want to do for the rest of this lecture is introduce you to the very low-level basic techniques for comparing constraint satisfaction problems for one template relative, or, you know, comparing that CSP to the CSP for another template. Okay? And here are the tools I'll talk about today: simulations, which leads us to PP definitions. Polymorphisms I've already talked about, but we'll see how polymorphisms are relevant to comparing constraint satisfaction problems, the so-called reduction to the idempotent case, and something that, well, has never really been written down in a one and only one way, but I'll describe it another way: algebraic substructures and PP constructions. We'll see what that is. So first, simulation. Let's look at an example. Consider G3 again. That was the one that encodes Horn 3-sat. Well, that's not G3. G3 is the one that encodes Horn 3-sat, which is G5. G5. Consider again G5. Where's G5? There's G5. Okay, you see that G3? That's G5. Okay, consider G5 again, the one with the the three-area relation that we can think of as saying X and Y imply Z, and also you can say I'm E0 or M1. That's G5. Suppose we modify it by naming it G3. No. Well, we'll still call it G5, but we're going to now add a four-area relation, a new, an extra relation to it, which is all four tuples except 1, 1, 1, 0. Okay, and think of this informally as saying, if the first three are equal to 1, then that forces the fourth term to be equal 1. Let's let G5 prime be this expanded template by adding this new relation. And the question is, okay, is the new thing harder than the original or not harder? Technically speaking, it is harder because now you have more, you have a new kind of constraint. You're going to have to add some software to deal with it. Okay, but actually it's not because the relation R110 X and Y implies Z can be used to simulate this new relation in a precise way. And here's how. The new relation on four variables, think of it as saying X and Y and Z implies W. Okay. Now, if I have an instance of the new constraint satisfaction problem, and it includes constraints of that form, well, to each of those constraints, we're going to eliminate it by introducing a new variable, T, and then we'll replace this constraint with these two constraints that say X and Y imply the new variable T, and T and Z imply W. Okay, if you think about it, if we were thinking of assigning values to X, Y, Z, and W that make this implication true, then there will be a value that we can assign to T that will make both of these constraints true. So we can delete this constraint at the expense of adding one new variable and these two constraints in the original problem. Okay. The key is that this new relation that we added is definable in our original structure by this formula. This relation holds if and only if there exists a T such that XYT makes R110 true and TZW also makes 110 true. Now this is a certain kind of formula, PP formula, that will generalize. So a PP formula or a primitive positive formula is just any first order formula which starts with existentially quantified variables and then you have a conjunction of relations, atomic formulas, applied to variables, where the assumption is that each atomic formula is either one of the basic relations that we have available or any quality between two variables. That's a PP formula. And whenever we have a relational structure, G, and another relation, S, on its domain, we say that S, the relation S, is PP definable in G, provided there exists a PP formula that defines S. That is, it's a formula using relations from G, and whose set of solutions in G is the relation in question, S. So this is S. And we know that whenever you have two finite relational structures, two templates, and we look at their corresponding constraint satisfaction problems, if every relation of H is PP definable in the structure G, then the constraint satisfaction problem for H is no harder than that for G, in the sense that we can simulate it we can simulate any instance for this using relations from G. And I put Leroux and Tessin here because they spelled out the details that the obvious reduction is a log space one. Okay, so this is the first tool. Yes. Well, okay. So, I mean, this is where I see the claim that it's a log space reduction. But I wouldn't know where to find the first reference to. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't read Schaefer's paper, but I don't think he did this. But you're right. But certainly by the 90s, by the early 90s, this was something that was known. But I don't have a first reference. Okay, so that's the first reduction simulation by PP formulas. There is a a little question that I need to answer. If I have a structure and another relation, and I want to know, is this relation PP definable in the structure, how do I know? Well, here's how you know. Theorem from the 60s, if G is a finite structure and E is a relation on it, then E is going to be PP definable in the structure precisely if E is compatible with every polymorphism of the structure. This is basic bread and butter connection between simulations for CSPs and polymorphisms, known since 68, rediscovered and reproved infinitely many times by various flavors of theoretical computer scientists. Proof sketch of 2.1. Do I have time to proof sketch this? Maybe I do. So the interesting implication is that 2 implies 1. Under the assumption that E is compatible with every polymorphism of the structure, show that there is a PP definition of E in the structure. And how do you prove it? Well, something like this. Assume 2. All right. And then let H be the structure G raised to the eth power. Now, what do I mean by this? I'm thinking of E as just a set. It's a set of tuples, of n tuples, I guess, if it's n-ary. Maybe it has 27 n tuples in it. So this is really just G to the 27th power, but I'm replacing a standard index set 1 through 27 with the set E itself as my indexing set for the power. And then forming the usual Cartesian direct product of the relational structure G to that power. Okay, and now E is n area. I want to find n specific elements in the domain of H. Okay, and which ones do I have in mind? Well, for each I from 1 to n, I let, what shall I call it, alpha I, let's say. Alpha I be the function from, well, I guess so the domain of G is A, so the domain of H is A to the E. So I want, I want a function from E to A itself. To be the function which picks up the ith coordinate of a tuple. So alpha I is just a projection, the ith projection, restricted to E. Okay, and this map, because it's a map from E to A, this is an element of A raised to the eth power, which is the domain of H. Okay, the domain of H. So each alpha I is one of the things in H, and now what we do. What we do is we have, here's H, and we have some elements, alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha n, and here's G. We look at all homomorphisms from H to G, and look at where the homomorphisms send alpha 1 through alpha n. So this homomorphism might send alpha 1 to f of alpha 1, and alpha 2 to f of alpha 2, and so forth. F of alpha n. And what we do is we collect the set of all, it's probably too low, isn't it? So here, what we do is we collect the set of all values of f at the alphas as f ranges over all homomorphisms from H to f. And it turns out that you can show it's always the case that this will contain the original relation E. Just the coordinate, so H is a power, just the coordinate projections of H itself will pick up everything that was in E. Okay? But assumption 2 can be shown to give the opposite inclusion, because homomorphisms from H to G are just homomorphisms from a power of G to itself. Those are just polymorphisms of G. Okay? And the assumption says something about polymorphisms, and what it says turns out in this case to give equality. So this argument says that under the assumption of 2, we can characterize E exactly as the set of solutions to something. Okay, well, and that characterization can now be turned into a primitive positive formula. It's just certain constraints on things have to map homomorphically, so, and then we existentially quantify away all of the elements of H except alpha 1 through alpha. Something like that, that's a rough sketch of the proof. In any case, it's true. It's true. Okay, corollary, if G and H are two finite relational structures with the same domain and the same polymorphisms, then their constraint satisfaction problems have the same complexity. Okay, do you see that? If they have the same domain and the same polymorphisms, their constraint satisfaction problems have the same complexity. Why? Well, let's suppose G has relations R sub 1 through R sub N, and H has relations S sub 1 through S sub T. If G and H have the same polymorphisms, that means each relation of G is compatible with all the polymorphisms of H. Because the polymorphisms of H are the same as the polymorphisms of G, and of course the polymorphisms of G are compatible with the relations of G. So that means by this theorem that every relation of G is PP definable in H. And conversely, every relation of H is PP definable in G. So the two structures are inter-PP definable, that is, the relations can each be simulated by the other, and therefore the CSPs have the same complexity. Yes? That they both belong to log space? No, they both might be NP-complete, for example. Yeah, I'm sorry. Are you asking if the constraint satisfaction problems themselves will belong to log space, or if the reductions, one to the other? Yeah, the reductions are log space reductions. Yep. Sorry? I'm sorry. Okay. If I refine the reductions to AC0, then I am out of my league of competence. I have no idea. Yeah. Does anyone? Yeah. That's again beyond my. Yeah. Equality is I know the obstacle for this reduction in the paper of LaRose and Tessin. Yark, did you? Who was what?
Geiger.
Oh, Geiger. Geiger, well, as far as I know, he wrote one paper. I don't know who he was. Do you know who he was? Yeah, I have no idea who he was. He wrote one paper. This was it. And if you read the paper, it's a very short paper. It almost says this. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can extract from it exactly this, but it's written in a kind of interesting style. It had the one advantage for me of being written in English, as opposed to the other paper that was written in Russian. But and maybe I should point out also that it is exactly here where I need my relations to be non-empty. But that's because I'm assuming my polymorphisms have arity at least one. If you wanted this theorem to be true and have empty relations, you need to modify your definition of polymorphism to include zero ary polymorphisms. That's a little detail. Okay, so moving on. The previous results motivate the following definition. Given a finite relational structure G, the polymorphism algebra of G is an algebra having the same domain as G, and for its clone of operations, we put the set of all of the polymorphisms of the structure. this turns out to always be a clone. So this is always an algebra in the proper sense. And this is what I want to call the polymorphism algebra of the structure. So every finite relational structure has associated to it a polymorphism algebra. It's simply what you get by where you throw away the relations and then you throw on all of the polymorphisms, the whole clone of polymorphisms of the original structure. That's the polymorphism algebra. And by the previous slide, this algebra completely determines the complexity of the constraint satisfaction problem corresponding to the structure up to log space reductions. And this fact, I would say, is the first insight of the so-called algebraic approach to CSP. Is it useful? Well, that's debatable, but this is the direction I'm going to go now. I want to go back and look at the examples and say what are the corresponding polymorphism algebras. Okay, so example G1 was over here. This was the algebra that encoded 3SAT. This was the structure whose CSP encodes 3SAT. And if you try to determine what are the polymorphisms of this structure, well, I'll leave it as an exercise to show that there aren't any except for the projections. And therefore, the polymorphism algebra of G1 is, the algebra whose only operations are the projections. That algebra we could informally present as having no operations, because no operations will always generate the projections. And having no operations means we're looking at a set, a naked set, the naked two-element set. That is the polymorphism algebra of G1. The naked two-element set. G2 was the example that encoded systems of linear equations. What polymorphisms do its relations have? If you think about, if you work it out, a function, an operation preserves S0 and S1, if and only if it's an affine function. That is, if and only if it's a sum of its variables, and in fact, the number of variables has to be odd. And in other words, the clone of polymorphisms consists just of all Boolean sums of odd numbers of variables. And the polymorphism algebra then is the algebra which has that set of operations as its clone. That clone is generated by the simplest one, the one that's just the sum of three variables. And so we can informally describe the polymorphism algebra here in that way. Algebra G2 is just the two-element set and clone generated by x plus y plus c. This, what is this? Well, it looks an awful lot like this, which is a group and a vector space over V2. So this is like a vector space. So like a vector space, as I said on the slide. What's next? G4 was this less than or equal to with 0 and 1. We saw that its constraint satisfaction problem encodes reachability. What are its polymorphisms? Well, you have to work it out. Because of the less than or equal to relation, a polymorphism will be monotone. It will have to preserve the less than or equal to relation. Because it has the singleton set 0, the singleton set 0 and the singleton set 1, a polymorphism must preserve them. So that means that if ever you have an input that's all zeros, it has to return a 0. That's preserving C0. And if ever you have an input that's all 1s, you have to return 1. That's preserving C1. An operation that satisfies these two properties on 0, 1 is called idempotent. And so the clone is exactly a set of idempotent monotone Boolean operations. That clone happens to be generated by the max and min function, we know. So in this case, the polymorphism algebra can be identified informally with the algebra on two elements with the min and max function. And this is the two-element lattice. The lattice theorist would say, wow, that's a lattice. G3, all we have are singleton set 0 and singleton set 1. Equality doesn't impose any constraint on polymorphisms. Every function will preserve the equality relation. And so the only constraint imposed by these relations is the constraint that an operation be idempotent. The polymorphisms of G3 consist of all idempotent Boolean functions. There's a lot of them, okay? That's almost all operations. Well, like half of them or something like that, or a quarter of them, but no, it's about a half of them. Anyway, it's think of it as being very rich, like sort of like a Boolean algebra, except that we're only including the idempotent operations. So where's my G3? Over there. Polalg G3 is like the two-element Boolean algebra. It's a little weaker, but it's not too much weaker. And that leaves G5. G5 had R110, the X and Y imply Z, and then the two singletons. It's the one that encoded Horn 3 set. What are its polymorphisms? Well, okay, this is a little exercise that one has to work out. It's not just a little exercise, it's a little work, but you do it, and you find that it's, what is it? Well, first of all, you can show that every polymorphism of this structure is monotone. That's step one. And idempotent, because C0 and C1 being there will force it to be idempotent. But it's more than being monotone and idempotent. Not every monotone idempotent operation is a polymorphism. The minimum function is, but the maximum function isn't. Exercise, okay? Do this once, then you'll say, okay, now I understand the definition of polymorphism. It turns out that the polymorphisms are exactly the ones that you can get by saying minimum of X1 and X3 and X7 and X11, let's say. Taking the minimum of several of the variables, that clone of operations is generated by the minimum function itself. So G5, the polymorphism algebra we can think of as just the two-element algebra with just the minimum operation, and that is a semilattice, known to algebraists as a semilattice. if you're not an algebraist, you're not excited by this. But an algebraist says, oh, wow, these are things I know. We understand these things. And I mentioned the complete graph. So for any greater than or equal to 3, the polymorphisms of Kn all depend on only one variable and are then just a permutation of the vertices applied to that variable. It's an exercise, a non-trivial exercise, worth working out. And therefore, the polymorphism algebra of Kn is, it's a set with some functions of one variable, some permutations. That's almost like a naked set. It's a set that's dressed up a little bit, okay, but not much more. Whereas K2 is much richer. Its polymorphisms consist of, K2 is just the two-element structure with the disequality relation, X is not equal Y. And an operation is compatible with that, provided it's self-dual. And there are lots of self-dual operations, including ternary X plus Y plus Z, including the three-area majority operation, which takes three inputs. And, well, there has to be a majority there. You know, we only have zeros and ones for inputs, and so there'll either be at least two zeros or at least two ones, and you return the output. That's the majority operation. And they are both self-dual, and an algebraist says, oh, if you got both of those, then you're basically, it's almost a Boolean algebra that you're looking at. It's not quite the full clone of the Boolean algebra because they have to be self-dual, and the constant zero function isn't self-dual, but it's just about that. So that's now those are the polymorphism algebras, and let's enter them now into the picture. Remember, here are our structures, and they're CSPs. Here are their polymorphism algebras, replacing them. G1, encoding 3-sat, had for its polymorphism algebra just the two-element set, the naked set. I call it set like it's down here. K3 and K4 were also down here. Their polymorphism algebras were almost naked sets, just sets with some permutations added to them. Vector space like that was G2. Its polymorphism algebra is like an affine space. Here were the Boolean-like ones that whose polymorphism algebra was very rich, almost as rich as the two-element Boolean algebra, and so forth and so on. And what you should be seeing here is that, which should also be obvious, that the more polymorphisms you have, the richer the polymorphism algebra, the easier the constraint satisfaction problem is. If you have almost no polymorphisms, that corresponds to the constraint satisfaction problem being very hard, NP-complete. And if you have almost all operations, then your constraint satisfaction problem is very easy. Because the more polymorphisms you have, the more constraints on the relations. The fewer relations are permitted to belong to the structure in the first place. And the relations are the constraints that can be used to build an instance of the constraint satisfaction problem. So if you have fewer constraints, there are fewer inputs to have to solve the problem for. I mean, that's one way to put it. In any case, the complexity of a constraint satisfaction problem comes from the complexity of its relations that you can build constraints from and their mutual interdependencies. If you have lots of polymorphisms, that doesn't leave you room to have many relations that for which they are polymorphisms. Does that help? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it made it from me. I didn't state it quite this way, but if the polymorphisms of one structure contain the polymorphisms of a second structure, okay, then the relations of the first structure are PP-definable and therefore can be simulated by the relations of the second structure. So the more relations you have, the more polymorphisms you have, the weaker the relations can be. And that's the intuition, and that's the second insight. I mean, that's or maybe just a retelling of that insight. And this is what you have to keep in mind. The richer the algebra, the easier the constraint satisfaction problem. Yes? That's not the way I think about it. But that's okay. All right. That's the picture. That's the picture. Okay. Now I want to talk about the reduction to the idempotent case. Bear with me if this is all known to you. Fix a finite structure. Okay. We say the structure is core. If each of its endomorphisms, homomorphisms from it to itself, is a bijection, is an automorphism. If all of its endomorphisms are automorphisms, okay? The complete graphs have this property, okay? That there's no proper endomorphism from it to a proper subset. And the structure is idempotent if its set of relations contains all of the singleton unary relations. For every element, the unary relation, which consists just of that element, is one of the relations in the set of basic relations. So by this definition, no graph is idempotent. So this doesn't quite match usage, perhaps, but this is how I'll be saying it. A structure is idempotent provided its set of relations contains all of the singleton unary relations. here's some remarks. First of all, a way to restate the definition of G being core is, well, endomorphisms are just one-airy polymorphisms. Endomorphisms are just one-airy polymorphisms. So G is core if and only if its one-airy polymorphisms are all permutations. This is not true. This is not true. Okay, so I'm going to say something that's false. Okay. It's almost true, though. 50% of it is true. Okay, if G is idempotent, then every one of its polymorphisms is an idempotent operation. That's where the terminology comes from. Because if the relations of G contain all of the unary relations, a polymorphism, which needs to preserve all relations, has to preserve these relations, and so for every A, it must send the tuple A, comma, A, comma, dot, 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 comma, A, it must send it to A, and it has to do it for every element, so it's an idempotent operation. So if G is idempotent, then the identity map, then every if G is idempotent, then the polymorphism algebra is an idempotent algebra. Okay, so this, on the first line, the forward direction is true. The reverse direction is not true. What is true is that if the polymorphism algebra is an idempotent algebra, if all of the polymorphisms of G are idempotent, then all of these singleton unary relations are PP definable in G. They may not actually be present given in the set of relations, but they're all PP definable. So that's what's actually true. Yes, I want to say if all it's, yeah, so this all. Yeah, you're right. Thank you. And I've corrected the statement of the first line of two, and it's an exercise. It needs a trivial exercise to show that an algebra is idempotent if and only if its only unary operation in the clone is the identity map, and that's translated back to polymorphisms. That's what the second line says. So these are just ways to reframe what the content of the definitions is. Using the language of polymorphisms. Item three will be known to anyone doing combinatorics. For every finite structure, there exists an induced substructure, which is core, and which has a retraction mapping the original structure onto it. A retraction is an endomorphism that is the identity on its range. And it's just a little combinatorial argument that proves this. And moreover, this induced substructure, this core-induced substructure, is unique up to isomorphism and is called the core of the original structure. Good. And if I write G superscript C, what I mean by that is what you get by augmenting G with all of the singleton unary relations. Okay. If they weren't already there, I add them to it, and now they're there. So G superscript C will definitely be idempotent, as I said. Okay, lemma. If G is finite and core of G is its core, then G and its core are the same CSP problem, or are equivalent to each other. Homomorphism-wise, literally, constraint-wise, up to log space reduction. Proof, well, an input in the homomorphism version maps homomorphically to G if and only if it maps homomorphically to the core of G. Because if I can map to G, then I can take the retraction and go from G to the core of G, and I have a map to the core of G. Conversely, if I can go to the core of G is an induced substructure, so then I can just, then I've gone to G. So they're the same problem. All right. Lemma. So this takes us from an arbitrary structure to core structures, and the second lemma takes us from core structures to idempotent structures. If G is core, then the constraint satisfaction problem for G and for G augmented with constants are also equivalent. I don't know how far back that goes, but again, the log space claim due to Lorentz and Tessin. And the proof is just a little encoding trick that I'll show you if you're interested. Okay, so taken together, these lemmas say that, well, okay, if you're looking at a finite template, you may as well assume its core and then add all of the singleton year relations so that you now have the assumption that it's idempotent. So, and that's what I've written here. For CSP, we always assume now, from now on, the template is idempotent. Okay, that's the next thing I wanted to say. Now I need to go on to algebraic structures. Sorry, algebraic substructures. I'm just inventing terminology here. Yeah. Yes. So for example, for K3. Well, let's suppose I started with K3. It's a graph. Well, may as well now add the three singleton relations that say, okay, in instances of the constraint satisfaction problem, you can say this variable must be assigned red, this one must be assigned blue. Yeah. So that's exactly what you're adding. And the claim is that if the original thing were easy, so is the new thing. If the new thing is hard, the original thing is hard. Okay, there was a question in the first lecture about whether induced substructures of a structure corresponded to subalgebras, and I kind of deflected that question. Well, here is the answer. There are induced substructures, but then there are what I want to call algebraic induced substructures, and they are not the same thing. What is an algebraic substructure? Well, suppose we have a finite structure and an induced substructure, say induced on the subset B, then we say that the induced substructure is an algebraic substructure of the original one, provided the domain of the substructure is a subalgebra of the polymorphism algebra of the original structure. Okay, so what's needed is that the domain not be arbitrary, but that it be a subalgebra of the corresponding polymorphism algebra. And here's just a quick example to show you that, okay, things aren't as they might seem. Here's K3. Let's pick the substructure on 0, 1. That's K2. Yes? Good. I was going to get to that the next slide, but you're, yes. yes, that's exactly it. To be, for 0, 1 to be, well, okay, first let me convince you that 0, 1 is not algebraic. That this is not an algebraic substructure. Well, remember K3 has endomorphisms has automorphisms that you know permute the vertices any way you want. And therefore 0,1 is not clearly not closed under polymorphisms because it's not closed under the all of the permutations of the vertices. Okay? So it's not closed and therefore it's not a subalgebra. To be a subalgebra means you're closed under all the operations of the algebra, which are the polymorphisms. Now, what Libor said was that, okay, equivalent to this definition is that the domain of the substructure be PP definable in the original structure, and that's because that is equivalent because PP definable is equivalent to being preserved by all the polymorphisms, by the Geiger et al. Theorem from 68. And so apparently, it's impossible to define the two-element set 0, 1 in the graph K3 with a PP formula. Now, and this is what I was saying, if H is an algebraic substructure of G, then the domain of H is preserved by all the polymorphisms of G, so is PP definable in G. Okay. Now, more generally, I want to say, PP definability. I want to permit construction of something that is substructure-like, but the domains don't need to be PP definable subsets of the original structure. They could be PP definable subsets of the square. That is, they could be PP-definable binary relations, or the domains could be PP-definable three-area relations. I also want to permit modding out by PP-definable equivalence relations. And then the relations that will go on these things, they could be induced, but they don't need to be. They could be anything that's PP-definable in the original. And that may seem a little mysterious, but let me illustrate it with an example. Here's an example, K3. Our friend K3. We love K3. It's so easy and yet so hard. K3 is a relational structure in the language that has one binary relation. Here is a formula in that language. I'm using arrow for the language of K3. Okay? Delta, in three variables, that says edge from x to y, and edge from y to z, and edge from z to x. This is a PP formula without existential quantifiers, so it's really easy PP formula. And what are its solutions? Well, solutions are all of the triangles that you can define. And they are 0, 1, 2. I mean, they're just all ways of listing the three vertices. This is the relation defined by this formula. Here's another formula. It's a six-area formula. It says, okay, it's in variables x, y, z, x prime, y prime, z prime. And it says there exists three more variables, x prime prime, y prime prime, z prime prime, such that the x, y, z are in this set, x prime, y prime, z prime is in the set, and x prime prime, y prime prime, z prime prime are in the set. So all three of these triples are triangles. And there is an edge from x to this quantified variable x double prime, and from x double prime to x, and other edges similarly said. So now what relation does this define? You'd have to work it out. You know, what six tuples are in it? Now, if you're in it, then your first three variables are a triangle, and your last three variables are a triangle. So you belong to delta. Which pairs of triangles from delta satisfy this relation? Well, if you work it out, sorry? One's of the same pair. You're either going, you know, clockwise or counterclockwise. So the relation defined by this formula is actually the equivalence relation on delta having the two obvious blocks. The clockwise, I'm missing a parenthesis here, pardon me, or counterclockwise, okay? So that means that, here's what I'm thinking of doing. I've defined delta as a three-area relation, a set of triples. Now I have a definable equivalence relation on delta that gives me two blocks, okay, and now I want to define a structure on those two blocks. I want to define K2, if that's what I'm trying to do. And here's a formula that permits us to define the edge relation that will give me K2 between the two blocks. Well, it is what it is. These will be on my web page. You can look at it and see if it really works, but it does. This defines a relation which is true of a pair of triples precisely if they come from different blocks. And the idea is that if I then take this definable three-area relation, mod this equivalence relation on it, and then apply this relation as a binary relation on the equivalence classes, I get exactly K2. And in this sense, although K2 is not an algebraic substructure of K3, it's PP constructible in it or from it. Yes? Sorry, which one? Yeah, I don't know how comfortable you are with that, but this is important. Okay, this notion of one structure being PP constructible from another structure via PP formulas is significant. Here is a general definition. It's probably too much to look at right now, but the idea is that if you have two relational structures, then the one, H, will be PP constructible from the other, G, provided there are a bunch of PP definable relations of G which define H up to isomorphism using potentially a quotienting by an equivalence relation, blah, 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 in the same way that this previous example was using. And the point is going to be that if one structure is PP constructible from G, then the CSP for H can be simulated in the CSP for G in roughly the same way that we did that we simulated just PP definable relations on the same domain. And that's this theorem right here. Suppose we have two finite structures, the second PP constructible from the first, then the CSP for the second can be simulated by the CSP for the first, and therefore there is a reduction. In particular, if any of the bad guys, K3 or G1, is PP constructible from G, then CSPG is NP complete. Because we can simulate the CSP for K3, which is NP complete, or the CSP for 3-sat, well, 3-sat in the CSP for G with these definitions. Okay, now let me connect this notion of PP constructibility that I kind of raced through with the first lecture about structures compatible with a variety. Suppose I have two finite relational structures, G and H. I claim that the following are equivalent. That H, the second, is PP constructible from G in the technical sense I've just defined. That I claim is equivalent to H being compatible with some algebra, some member of the variety generated by the polymorphism algebra for G. And I'm going to inflict the proof on you, okay, to make sure that you're following me. How do we prove this? Well, the interesting direction is 2 implies 1, that H being compatible with some member of this generated variety, where the algebra is the polymorphism algebra of G, that leading to a PP construction of H from G. Notation. Let me say that A is the domain of G. I'm going to need to refer to the domain of G. And the domain of H will be some other set, B, and here are its relations. The relations of B need not be correlated with the relations of G. Let bold A be the polymorphism algebra of G. The assumption is that H is compatible with some member of the variety generated by A. So let's choose bold B as the algebra in that variety, with respect to which H is compatible. So B is some algebra in the variety. Its domain is the same as the domain of H, and the relations of H are compatible with the operations of B. That's the assumption. Okay, B is, by definition, a homomorphic image of a subpower of A. Without loss of generality, I can assume that it's a quotient of a subpower of A. So let's assume B is the quotient of the subpower U by the congruence E. You're either with me or you're finding this very painful. Now, U is a subpower of A. Let's say it's a subalgebra of the kth power, just to fix which power. The congruence E of U is a set of ordered pairs from U. We can think of it then as a set of ordered 2k tuples from A. So let's think of it that way. It's a 2k area relation on the domain of A, which is the domain of G. And for each of the relations, let's see, each of the relations of H, each of the R's, is a relation on the set B. Each element of B is an equivalence class of E in U, so we can lift or pull back each n-area relation in here to get a kn-area relation on the set A itself. I just throw that out. If you really wanted to figure that out, you could sort it out. But the idea is that we can associate to the relations of H corresponding relations on the set A, but multiplying the area by K. And it, And because we're assuming that H is compatible with the algebra B, which is a quotient of a subpower of A, it turns out that all of these relations I've defined on the set A are compatible with the algebra A. It just will follow my definition, which is the polymorphism algebra of the structure G. So all of these relations are compatible with all of the polymorphisms of G. So they are PP definable in G, right? And they give us the PP construction of H from G. Okay, so there is a connection between this notion of PP constructibility and the notion of a structure compatible with an algebra in a variety that I was talking about in the first lecture. As a corollary, I claim that this structure G1 is PP constructible from G. Well, okay, this structure G1, that's the one that encodes 3 set, is PP constructible from an arbitrary structure G if and only if this structure G1 is compatible with an algebra in the variety generated by the polymorphism algebra of G by the previous theorem. But that can only happen if that algebra to which it is compatible has nothing but projections, because this structure has no polymorphisms except for projections. So this is equivalent to the variety generated by the polymorphism algebra of G containing a two-element algebra that has no operations other than projections, the naked two-element set. And of course, if condition one holds, and therefore equivalently if condition two holds, then the constraint satisfaction problem for G is NP-complete. This test for NP-completeness subsumes all known tests for NP-completeness of constraint fixed template constraint satisfaction problems. As far as we know, this is the only reason for a fixed template CSP to be NP-complete. And the algebraic dichotomy conjecture says that conversely, well, at least if the template is idempotent and these conditions don't hold, then the constraint satisfaction problem should be in P. That's the algebraic dichotomy conjecture to Bulatov, Jevons, and Crokin. Oh, is that my last slide? Holy crap. Is there any more? No, that's it. Okay, so I got as far as a statement, one statement of the algebraic dichotomy conjecture, and let me just stress it. The conjecture is that assuming G is idempotent, assuming that we're only talking about a template that where all of the singleton unary relations are present, then the only reason for being hard, for the CSP being hard, is if the variety generated by its polymorphism algebra contains a naked two-element set. That's how an algebraist would say it. But equivalent to that is that that the two-element structure that encodes 3 set is PP constructible from G. There are other equivalents that can be said slightly more easily. For example, you don't need all of these three-element relations. Just two of them will do. Or their intersection, which is known as not all equals relation, will do. Another equivalent is that the graph K3 be PP constructible from G. That is equivalent to the only reason that we know for CSPG to be NP complete. And I believe Yarick plans to talk about other equivalent versions to these conditions. And in my next lecture, I will also talk about other conditions that are equivalent to either of these two conditions. But in any case, the conjecture is that they capture those CSPs in the idempotent case that should be hard. And what remains to show is that in the absence of these conditions, they're easy. So, yes? Yeah, if H is constructible from G, okay, then then H is no harder than G. So if H is hard, then G also has to be hard. Well, if G is easy, then H is easy. But that's all you get. I believe that to be, it's going to be true. I mean, for example, every finite structure is PP constructible in K3, or from K3. K3 is so rich that every finite relational structure is PP constructible from it. I don't know if it's ever been written down anywhere, but it's true, it can be proved, and it is a case that, of course, every structure is no harder than K3. Okay. Now, I'm not sure that I can go out on a limb and say, and that should be the only reason for a comparison between the difficulties of CSPs. Of course, I would only be claiming that for the idempotent case. But I don't know what's happening below P. You know, I mean, once you're in P, which is where all of our unknown things are happening, there are all sorts of things that are. I don't know how fine the reduction would have to. I would have to state the reduction if log space reduction would be enough, or maybe even the first order reductions I'm talking about. In the end, I might be talking about, well, PP constructible reductions. You know, might be all that I could point to that where that could prove that. So I guess we don't know that. That would be an open question. Is it the case that if CSP of G, if CSP of H has a, let's say, a first order reduction to CSP of G, does that mean H is PP constructible from G? I don't know how we could answer that question. Since we don't actually, you know, but maybe we could. Maybe from the reduction itself, there would be some hope of proving. Oh, okay. I don't know that this is the most general that one needs. Yeah, but the conjecture is that it's the most general that we need to separate NP complete from P. Right, and I believe there are some finer conjectures that will separate P complete from NL and NL complete from L, and I think that if those conjectures, I'd have to work it out, but if those conjectures were true, then it would verify that this is the only thing that you need to separate those as well. I don't know that for a fact, but that's what I'm guessing. Yes? Oh, it's grotesque. I mean, here's an exercise. Take K3 superscript C. That's just K3 with the three unary relations added to it. PP construct that from K3. I claim that every finite relational structure is PP constructible from K3, so that one is PP constructible from K3. It's complicated. Yes, there is a recipe in the proof, yes. Any other questions? Yes. No, that's a good question. K3 itself has those permutations. If you go to the third power, there is a recipe. I would have to just turn to the recipe. If If we were talking about K3 with constants, then it's easy, because K3 with constants being idempotent, every subset is a subalgebra. Okay, so we can just go down to an induced 2-element thing and it's naked. But given that it's not that, then it's a bit more complicated. One has to go to essentially the free algebra on one generator and the variety that the polymorphism algebra generates, and that's in this case going to the third power, and then doing something. And there's a recipe for it, but it isn't particularly straight. No. Is there anything more informative that anyone can say to Venkat's question? Yeah, well, knowing that there is you have to have then the witness in the variety. You have to know that on the polymorphism algebra side in the generated variety that you do have some two-element algebra, which is incompatible the two-element G3. Okay, that'll be the naked set in the generated variety, but you still need to have that in place. And I haven't shown you I haven't proved or explained why, if the structure is K3, why that algebra should be there. I just claimed it. I just said, okay, it doesn't violate the conjecture. That must be because in its generated variety there does exist this two-element set. But where is it? Okay, I think, well, you have to go to the third power and then do something. And I, at the tip of my, tell me I don't actually have it, but I could work through the, I may start the next lecture by showing you how to do that. Yes, we will. I'm sorry? Yes. In item 2, you can do what? Oh, yeah, right, good. Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. So this is not the normal way that this, the algebraic dichotomy conjecture doesn't point to these two conditions typically. Assuming that G is idempotent, condition 2 holds, that is, you can find the two-element naked set in HSP in the variety generated by the polymorphism algebra, if and only if you can find it in HS of the polymorphism algebra, that is, in a quotient of a subalgebra of the polymorphism algebra itself. So it's actually, in the idempotent case, you don't have to look far into the variety to find the thing. So I guess, but see, K3 is not idempotent, so it doesn't apply, that observation does not apply to K3. Sorry? Yeah, right. Thank you. Okay, I'm done. So, on to coffee. Thank you. Before I start defaming people.